women are supposed to be able to go to each other when their emotions are high and their logic is low, go to another woman whose logic is high and emotions are low, and connect with her, and the other woman will talk you through it and decrease your agitation and then comfort you and increase your logic. And by the end of it, you may not have a solution, but you have bonded with her, you've shared with her, you've opened up, you've connected, you've received acceptance, and now you can actually think through the solution on your own. Women are supposed to be able to process with each other like this. Now we have therapists because we don't have anyone in our life that we can process things with.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this latest episode of Girl Boss Interrupted. This is the pinnacle of our love-themed February episodes, and in it, I will be speaking with Adam Lane Smith. He is the attachment specialist on YouTube. He has a Master's of Arts in Psychology and was a licensed therapist for many years who has helped thousands of couples communicate better by addressing their formative attachment wounds, and he has all sorts of great advice for people who are looking to find good relationships, maintain the ones they have, or improve them. So, if you enjoyed this episode, as always, like, share, subscribe, leave me a comment, and we will chat again in 2 weeks.
All right, here we go. Adam Lane Smith, welcome to Girl Boss Interrupted.
Thank you. It's fun to be here. I can't wait for this.
Yeah. So as I was just telling Adam behind the scenes, I've been really interested in his work specifically for a long time because of this sort of theory I have that so many of the social struggles that we modern women face kind of boil down to attachment issues in one way or the other. So Adam is an attachment specialist, and let's start this off by with you just telling us a little bit about how you became interested in this, and you know what your qualifications are, a little bit of your work history.
Absolutely. So I am Adam Lane Smith. I am the attachment specialist. I have been at this, learning and studying this, and helping people for 15 years. It started when I grew up with my own attachment issues, but I didn't know what they were called. And I had anxious attachment. I had to fix that as a young man. I got married, fixed my attachment, got married, and decided to pursue psychology all in roughly the same time span. So I've been at this for 15 years, and I have my 14-year wedding anniversary with my wife the next week, and 4 children of my own. So I have had to live attachment, but I fixed it myself, and I said, what the heck did I just do? Anxious attachment is all about seeking approval from people, feeling alone, feeling like you're not good enough. I had to fix that alone and then figure out what I had just fixed because I couldn't, life was terrible that way. So I went to school, got my master's degree in psychology, emphasis marriage and family therapy because I was looking for relationships more than individual pieces. And going through school, we covered something called attachment theory. And I said, oh, what is this? This looks like something I want to study. And they said, oh, No, don't worry about that. That only matters if you're working with little tiny children. If it's an attachment thing in adulthood, it is always a personality disorder. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. And as I have learned since then from working with other clinicians, from leading seminars to train healthcare professionals, from going around talking to healthcare professionals and teachers all through the United States and Canada and Europe, that is the general teaching that they give at most universities for psychology. So most psychology professionals do not come out understanding a thing about attachment. So I didn't learn about it then, sadly. I went on 6 years for a master's degree and then 3 years of apprenticeship working in the field under other clinicians to get your license. It's 9 years to become a therapist. And during that time, I found that most of the disorders I was working with had that same factor underlying that I had fixed that I didn't have a word for. And I was trying to fix it and help people through it underneath their diagnoses, what was really going on. And I finally read some books and some studies that people had been doing on the fringes of the psychology movement about applying attachment to adults. And very few people were speaking about it. It was almost no one in the world talking about attachment and adults. And as I started piecing these things together, I said, wait a minute, this is what I've been looking for. This was it. So I studied it. I wrote a couple of books on it and started teaching it to my patients. And they just, it was like overwhelming changes. When they would come in with borderline personality disorder, they would the attachment obviously would help. When they come with bipolar disorder, or bipolar 1 or bipolar 2, we'd start working on attachment, and many of their symptoms would go away. And we're told that that doesn't get better without just medication, and only medication is helpful. Nothing else is helpful. No, it turns out working on attachment actually diminished many of their symptoms down to one episode a year. And instead of severe, it was one mild episode a year. And some of these people have been having ongoing manic episodes over and over and over. Anxious attachment, depression, suicidal feelings, self-harm, couples having problems. I was a marriage and family therapist working with couples. I kept finding attachment at the core of all these diagnoses that we were taught to treat. But no one knew that this was at the core. This was the thing that they had told us in school, like, well, we're not sure why these things happen, or why people are resilient, or why people get these, or why one person gets one mental disorder instead of another one. We just treat the diagnoses and just move on as best we can and help people through them. And hopefully we can help them recover. And that's the general gist of what you're given. The attachment was the piece that locked it all together. So I started teaching and leading seminars for healthcare professionals, teaching online for years. And my books became a big hit, and it became apparent I needed to teach this bigger, but with my state, I could not do therapy and coach people outside of the state. I couldn't do therapy outside of the state. I could only stay in that one little state. So I gave up that license so that I could coach everyone everywhere, teach, do live streams, do group coaching, everything everywhere. Like I said, this has been 15 years. I am the attachment specialist because I've had to become that. There's very, very few people in this world who do what I do yet.
Yeah, no, I think it's really cool and interesting. And I mean, are you familiar with Dr. Romani, who does a similar thing for narcissism, narcissistic personality disorder?
Yep.
I feel like you, like what she is to that body of work, you are to attachment theory.
Absolutely.
For people who aren't familiar, what is attachment theory?
So attachment theory is the belief that when you are born, you begin forming your ability to connect to other human beings based on if your parents take care of you, hold you, love you, meet your needs fairly quickly, or if they don't, if mom is present, if dad is present, if they're screaming at each other all the time, if they hit you, if they abuse you, if they abandon you, if you're confused by their behavior. It's the belief of either secure attachment, I am going to get my needs met because people care about me and people are mostly good and people will want to meet each other's needs and people act in good faith and I can ask for my needs to get met because I'm a person who deserves to get my needs met. All people do. That's secure attachment, and you have to teach this to your children when they're born. And then attachment can break in three different ways. Number one, if something goes wrong, your brain as a little child can think, someone didn't care for me, or someone hurt me, or someone abandoned me, or I was deeply confused by how someone acted toward me over and over and over. I must be the problem. They must be treating me this way because I don't deserve to be treated well. There's something wrong with me that my family can see, that I don't know what it is, but everyone can see it and I will be abandoned. So I have to earn approval. I have to beg for things to go my way. People will leave me if they see how worthless I am. I have to earn love and approval from people by doing good things for them. And you're always afraid of being abandoned. And then there's avoidant attachment, which is the opposite of these people are crazy. Everyone is crazy. No one is ever going to act in good faith. Everyone is going to betray me eventually. Everyone is going to use whatever they can against me. People are out for themselves. No one will ever work with me in good faith with real love. Love is not a real thing that happens. It's all just feelings until someone gets stressed enough to betray me. And that's avoidance style. And they will push people away and keep away from people. Sometimes they'll manipulate people. Depends how severe they are in that territory. And that's heading toward narcissistic personality disorder, which is the extreme version of that avoidance style. Then you can have a blend of the two, disorganized style. You go back and forth where you're saying, you know, I can never be safe. I'm going to be abandoned, but I'm also going to get hurt. I can't trust anyone. I'll get close and earn approval because I crave it. But then I get terrified when I'm in too close. So then I run. And if something goes wrong, I'm going to burn it all down and run because I'm going to get hurt. So it's you can't fire me because I quit. And they bail out of the relationships as fast as they can. That is a rough overview of the attachment styles. But you track this onto adulthood. And this is how you interact, especially in your romantic and dating relationships, your marriage. This is why people get divorced so much. This is why so many problems exist in our modern society.
Yeah, and, you know, it makes a lot of sense to me, too, that these things can exist on a spectrum. Like, there's probably nobody on Earth who is, because nobody on Earth has perfect parents, because nobody on Earth is a perfect parent, who is, you know, perfectly securely attached. You know, everybody has some issues, like, their parents fail them in some ways, and so they exist on, like, maybe the good side of the spectrum with, like, fewer issues than most people and can generally get by. Mm-hmm. And then there are those people with, like, you know, cluster B personality disorders who really suffered and are, you know, the diagnosis is going to be really more difficult. And then it's all these people in the middle who, in my view, like, I don't know, like nobody is talking to them to the extent that we do talk about, like you were saying, like to the extent we talk about attachment, it's about children or really extreme cases. Do you see, this is something that I'm fairly critical of on the podcast, and so I always like to sort of gauge and, you know, check if what I'm saying is making sense or, you know, conforming to reality in some way. But do you get the sense in the field of psychology that there is a bit of an over-reliance on medication? Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, in school, we're taught that this is just how it goes. You just have this disorder, and you can work through it with some therapy, and you probably need medication, and it's probably both. And let's throw some medication at it. The work is hard, and if very few people know about attachment, you don't go into your therapist, and they say, oh, this is an attachment problem. Let's work through it really quick, and you'll be done in a few weeks, and you'll have everything taken care of. It's, well, we can work on these symptoms. It's going to take 6 months to a year, maybe 2 years. And here's some medication. Maybe that'll help in the meantime. And maybe you just need to take an antidepressant for the rest of your life, off and on, when you have random episodes. Our society does not look for the root cause. We don't even know that there is a root cause.
Right. And there seems to be a real skepticism of that kind of therapy, of the kind of therapy that would be, that is interested in root causes and not just, I don't know, affirming.
It's, well, in therapy, we are, they're churning out therapists, shall we say, here in the United States. They're churning them out as fast as they can in the United States. And they are working with them and teaching them toward the diagnostic manual, which is a diagnostic manual. It's a compilation of all the diagnoses you can get as agreed upon every few years when they revise the book. And that is what you are mostly taught to, is those diagnoses. So attachment issues are not a diagnosis. Personality disorders are where it becomes severe enough to warrant a diagnosis in the healthcare industry. Attachment issues are not. It's what we call the walking wounded. It's the people who have wounds that are invisible, but they can love, they can work, they can do most things. It's just that it destroys you slower. It sabotages your relationships over 10 years, over 20 years, instead of sabotaging your relationships every 6 months. That's why it's not a diagnosis, and most therapists have no idea. There's no idea.
Do you have a formula or a sort of, I don't know, an easy way for people who are walking wounded, let's say, to wonder and sort of explore their themselves intellectually and think, maybe, do I have an attachment problem?
Yes. So I don't do quizzes. Most people try to take online quizzes, and I'm not much a fan of those because you click a few buttons and then they spit out a rough idea of what you could be. And it's, oh, hey, look, I'm this. And you take it twice, you'll get two different results. I've written up a document that I use with my clients when I coach my clients. It's available on my website, adamlanesmith.com, but it's the four different attachment styles. And really, here's what I run people through is, you know, do you, with anxious attachment style, do you find yourself seeking approval? Do you find yourself thinking there's something wrong with you that doesn't deserve to be loved? Are you terrified to share your needs? Are you constantly thinking you're going to be abandoned? Do you have emotional impermanence, which is like a baby? Right? If they, here, I'll use my ring right here. If you have a baby, this is an object impermanence. And if you cover it up, the baby will think, oh, the ring is really gone. And you uncover it, oh, it's still there. And that's object permanence. A baby has to learn that. We, with anxious attachment style, people have what's called emotional impermanence. Someone loves you and they tell you they love you, then they walk away and you send them a text and they don't respond for half an hour and you start freaking out thinking their love for you is gone until they respond and reassure you, oh, no, it's still there. It's emotional impermanence. That's a big feature, especially of anxious attachment style. So there's that. Do you have those issues? Okay, then you probably have anxious attachment. We need to work on that and get you to a place where you can feel safer in those relationships. Avoidance style, do you believe everyone is out for themselves? Do you struggle to get close to anyone? Does it make you afraid to think of connecting to someone? Not because you think you're bad, but because you think other people are just never going to be worthy of that trust, that they're always going to betray you in the end. Do you think everyone is going to betray you eventually? Pretty good sign of avoidant attachment style. And then do you just stay away from them and keep safe in what I call the nervous avoidant style? Just you stay safe and stay away from people. Maybe you have some hookups, or maybe you get into one relationship and blow it up in 6 months and you're done, but you stay away from people. Or, here's the really rough part, you start manipulating, gaslighting, controlling, love bombing, all these things that manage other people instead of loving them. So you are managing their feelings in advance to make them act the way you want them to act. You're moving them as if they're an object. You don't think of them quite like an object yet, but you're moving them as if they're more of an object or a livestock, a beast of burden, moving them. That's avoidant attachment style. And are you just overwhelmed with that fear, back and forth, hot and cold, and you want to get in, but then you want to run, but then you want to be there, but then you want to run? That's usually the disorganized style. It's chaotic. It's fearful. It's just as hurtful for you as it is for the people that you end up accidentally hurting. And the disorganized people have a lot of relationship regret. They're the ones with the biggest relationship regrets. That's the best breakdown I can give right there. And usually people will identify with one of those three.
Yeah. So, That was a lot. But I'm glad you brought up relationships because, you know, as we were talking about earlier, this is a podcast for women and about women's issues and men's issues too, but women's and men's issues as distinct, unique sort of categories. So, can you tell me a little bit about why you think that the statistics for female happiness, I think it's called what, the paradox of declining female happiness, where in this world where we're just achieving more and more forms of like liberation and freedom and all that, women's happiness just continues to degrade over time. First of all, it does that, once again, conform with reality? And if so, what are your thoughts?
It does in all the areas where women are suffering with attachment issues and their safety nets are being broken. We are supposed to have five main safety nets that we're supposed to connect to: our immediate family, our surrounding family, then the extended family, then the kith and kin network that's outside of that, and then either our neighborhood or our village or our small town, and then our religious community, of whatever type that is. We're supposed to have five safety nets of people that we can connect to. And all five of those have been shattered in our society. So women are out here alone in this world. And I'm big on evolutionary psychology. And 10,000 years ago, a woman who's alone in the wilderness, surrounded by people who don't understand her and no alliances, no connections, that woman is dead. That woman is, she's not going to survive. She might try to find a stranger and start a family all over again, but that is worst case scenario for our ancestors' brains. Worst case scenario is a woman out there all alone, no allies to trust, broken family, no intimacy, no contact, no trust, no connection, everything superficial. She is like, that's women on the frontier alone in the wilderness, in the woods, except now you're also surrounded by all these potentially hostile people who may try to hurt you. And now you have to find a stranger in a meat market to try to marry you. But first you have to sleep with him for 5 years and hope that he will pity you enough to marry you. That's our modern world that we've created for women. And there's no amount of Netflix or shopping or money or even financial security or a great job or pets or whatever it is. There is nothing in this world that can make up for that level of existential dread that women have to live with every minute of every day. And of course they're miserable.
Wow. It was very powerfully said. Yeah, it's so strange. It's like the very thing that would have been, as you said, existentially dreadful, like literally life or death situation, has become a cultural ideal. I don't need no man. I can do it by myself. You know, independence at the cost of basically anything. And it, you know, it almost feels, you know, as a woman having grown up in this environment, it's like any form of dependency is pathologized completely. So it almost seems like there's like this, I don't know, would you call it like a cultural anxious attachment or something?
Our culture fosters attachment issues, for sure. It does. By design, it fosters attachment issues and pulls you out into the world to be completely alone, to not trust anyone. Our culture, American culture, began almost with the ideal of avoidant attachment, of don't trust anyone ever. But the descendants of that have now become so broken up in anxiety and fear and terror that either it's don't ever trust anybody or you are worthless and you don't deserve to be loved. And you don't even have to find a man to take care of you. It's, where is your family? Where's your network? Mm. Where's all the other women that you should be able to connect with to get help? Where's your 10 aunts who should be there to help you find a good husband that they have known for 10 years? Where's the people that you should be, your sisters, your cousins, your mother, your grandmother, like all the women in your community who should be there for you? Where is that? We don't even have that. Women are utterly alone and alienated from their world. That is worst case scenario. Not just not having a man to take care of you, but not having any of your women in your network that you should have to help you in this world.
Oh yeah, I'm sure you've seen this in your line of work. The algorithm must have shown you, you know, these women who are becoming new moms, mm-hmm. and sort of discovering that there's no village, and sort of wondering where all the other women are. You've seen that?
Oh, yes. Moms. Well, my wife and I, we have 4 kids. And when we started having kids, it was like, where is everyone at? Like, why don't we have childcare? Why isn't there someone here to help us? Why isn't anyone here to help us take a nap or any of that? I work 12-hour shifts and she's a stay-at-home mom. And we're looking around like, wouldn't it be nice if we had all these female relatives coming over to give her a nap and take care of her and help her take care of the kids and she could take care of them? Wouldn't that be amazing? Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Yeah. But that's not how our society is set up. It's every woman is alone in her home and has to do 100% of everything. And when this really kicked off, when that idea really kicked off back in the 40s, the 50s, especially 60s, they developed was it Valium, and they called it Mama's Little Helper. It was mom's little helper because it was the only thing she had to help her get through her day, taking care of her family alone. And no wonder women are backing off of that now, and they're just isolated and really alone, even though they don't want to be. It's just the stress is off the charts to even try to have a family now.
Yeah. Yeah, I've often been, we've spoken about this on the podcast with other people. I think there is some real element of truth in the criticism of the 1950s housewife and just how, you know, they called it sort of boredom and ennui, but I think it was much deeper than that. I think it was deep loneliness, you know, but then the answer that was presented was like almost worse than the thing itself. The answer is, well, no, you just become like the husband that left you for the marketplace. You, whatever your husband did to you, you do to your children, you know?
Yes.
So let me ask you, sort of getting back to the society-wide questions for a little bit, why do you think that so many people suffer with attachment issues?
Because we are raised in families where we either don't know how to do the good things that would build loving, intimate attachment with our children. For example, oxytocin is a hormone that needs to be released, and we need to have that with our children. Breastfeeding, for example, so the whole movement over toward formula for so long. Children didn't get breastfed. They didn't get a ton of oxytocin bonding they should have got. And the moms didn't get a ton of oxytocin bonding they should have got to their children. Now we have moms who can't breastfeed for hardly at all because their oxytocin levels are so low, their bonding hormones are so low, that they can't let down the milk, so then babies can't pull enough, so then it looks like they don't have a good milk supply. They do, but the baby can't get it out. And then they switch to formula and they lose all that oxytocin bonding. But then we're alone. Then we have to dump our child off in daycare where the child has to earn approval from strangers to get attention. Mom comes home after working 2 or 3 jobs and is exhausted, barely has time to play with the baby. And the message the baby gets is, I'm not worth her time and attention. She's not excited to see me and she's been gone all day. I must be a bad kid. We have messages like, sometimes love just doesn't work out. That's why we're getting divorced. Or, well, where's dad? I don't know. He's probably like killed himself under a bridge. Or, you know, all these messages that we get of love isn't real. you can't trust anybody. And a child's brain doesn't interpret that well. It interprets it as, this is my fault, I earned this. Or it interprets it as, wow, everyone is scary and I can't trust anyone because they're all going to hurt me. And then it just tracks that forward into the world. There are so many things we're doing that wreck children's ability to connect other people. And we have been for generations. It's got worse. I've tracked it over the last 100 years of brokenness from World War One, even a little before World War One, to now. And it's getting worse with every generation, to the point now they say the research suggests up to 50% of adults may have attachment issues now. Half of American adults may have attachment issues. And it actually could be higher than that in the newer generations, in our generation, in the generation below us. It could be more like 60 or 70% have attachment issues now, don't have secure attachment. It's getting worse. And we've got to turn it around. And each one of us has to fix it, because if we are the problem, we can pass that attachment issue right on to our children without even meaning to. Not doing the bad things, but failing to do the good things.
Mm. Wow. So I want to ask you about some of those solutions and real practical steps in just mm-hmm. a second. Mm-hmm. But I would like to talk about men's issues now.
Sure.
For a moment. Because, you know, despite the fact that this is a women's podcast, there are two sides to this coin.
Sure.
And I feel like really one lends a lot of insight into the other.
Sure.
And certainly understanding the two sides can lend some insight into the gender wars themselves.
Sure.
And the struggles with relationships.
And every woman who listens to this podcast has probably at least met a man somewhere and probably would like to know what men are thinking and how to help them with their hurting.
Right. Yeah. So what's going on with guys?
So where women tend to thrive when they feel loved and when they feel useful to the people that they love. So when they're safe in a safe network, and then they feel useful to that network and really give back to their family, their community, their whoever it is, that's where women tend to thrive. Feeling loved and appreciated, and then feeling useful to those people as well and taking care of them. That's where women thrive. And you can see how that is already broken in our society, because you're not allowed to feel loved. Hookup culture, for example, is the art of making women feel grateful for being used, and that's not love. And they can't really connect other people to give either, because then they just get taken advantage of and hurt and wounded and called codependent or whatever it is. So women are alone in that regard. Men, it's usually purpose. It's purpose and mission. We've all seen the memes of the male apartment, right? Where it's a lawn chair, a TV, and an Xbox, and that's it. That's how men live if they have no mission or no purpose and no reason to have more than that. When they connect with other people and they want to build a legacy, they want to have a purpose, that comes from human relationships, and men don't know how to have human relationships. So there is no purpose in any man's life anymore. He's outcast from his family. He doesn't know what women want. He doesn't know how to connect to a woman. He's actually, most women are afraid to ask for commitment. And most men are also afraid to ask for commitment. So most men and most women in the dating pool, I coach both sides. And they come in, they say, Adam, I want commitment so bad. And I say, okay, here's how you do it in the first couple of dates. And they say, I can never talk about commitment in the first few dates. Men and women both say this, because she'll leave or he'll leave. No one would want that. Everybody is wanting that, but men and women are conditioned now. We can't ask for commitment. There's no purpose. There's no bonding. And men are even more alone, because women at least can say, I'm feeling sad. I need a hug. And someone somewhere will give her a hug. Women can walk out on the street corner and say, I want a boyfriend. And she'll have 10 guys line up. If a guy walks out on a street corner and says, I want a girlfriend, he's probably going to be thrown in jail. So it's men don't have the backup.
Yeah.
to the backup that women do. Women at least have that access to someone somewhere will care about them. The research shows that if you have pictures of, you know, men suffering and women suffering, the person will react more to the woman suffering. We have all kinds of evidence that people react to a woman suffering more than they'll react to a man suffering. Just massive amounts of evidence and research has gone into this. And so men are utterly alone. It's why the male suicide epidemic is through the roof and growing worse. And we don't talk about that at all, but it's an overwhelming number of sons and brothers and cousins and uncles and dads who are committing suicide. So yes, every woman who's probably listening to this has either seen a man in their life be depressed or has seen a man take his own life because he was so depressed. Yeah, that's men are not doing well. Really not doing well here.
Yeah, for both, in both cases, something that's really standing out to me is the lack of single sex spaces and intimate spaces for men to be intimate. I'm not talking about sexually intimate, but emotionally intimate with one another.
Absolutely.
And for women to be emotionally intimate with one another, you know. So let's get to the practical. Mm-hmm. The practical, how do we improve our lives? How do we overcome these issues? Mm-hmm. I guess we should probably start with the personal. If you're somebody who identifies this in yourself, let's start with women. Mm-hmm. What are some ways to take practical steps to improve mm-hmm. your life and overcome these shortcomings?
Mm-hmm. So most women are more likely to have an anxious attachment style of I don't deserve to be loved. And there's something wrong with me on the inside. Women are more likely to have that one. But some women will also, many women, especially professional women, if they rise through the ranks, if they've had a few hookups, if they've been in hookup culture, even if they hate it, they will often more likely than have avoidant attachment style. Makes it difficult to connect, makes it difficult to climax, makes it difficult to enjoy themselves at all. Very, very common for that to happen. If that's the case, here's what needs to happen is you need to decrease your anxiety response to opening up to other people enough that you're able to open up to people. I teach through my coaching all kinds of body techniques, but plenty of women do yoga, running, weightlifting. When you hit that endurance phase, it begins draining the emotional brain's agitation on this side, the emotional brain, and that starts restoring logical functioning so that you can then work through some of the anxiety instead of your emotional brain being spiked and your logic being low like this on the different sides of the brain. So when you decrease your anxiety enough, you can then go out and have the conversations with other people that you are having in your head, because the logic diminishes and your emotion skyrockets. You start ruminating on the emotional brain. You know, does he really love me? Does he hate me? Is he mad at me? He hasn't answered his phone in 3 seconds. You know, we had this fight. What do we do? Is it over? And women will blow up a relationship and ruin it in 10 minutes of not getting a response because they freaked out and they want to send a text like, well, I hope whoever she is that you're doing great and he's at work, you know, things like that. Stop.
Yeah.
Learn to stop that and then have what I call the I'm an anxious person speech of, you may not know this about me, to two or three people in your life that you trust. I'm anxious. I'm an anxious person. Here's some of my behaviors. Here's my internal world. Here's how insecure I am. I either am afraid there's something wrong with me that's not lovable, so I cover it up and I try to earn approval, but I'm always afraid of being abandoned. Or, you know, I have a hard time ever trusting anyone because I never feel like it's going to work out. And I always am terrified to open up and be honest about what I need, who I am. I can't ask for those things. And then you say, I don't want to do this anymore. Can I please have an honest relationship with you? And can you accept me even knowing this about me? Be one of the hardest conversations you've ever had in your life. But as that person accepts you, you begin healing that attachment. It fixes it. And you start realizing, wow, I was wrong. There's not something wrong with me on the inside. People can accept me. Or there's actually people out there who will work in good faith with me and not take advantage of me. And as you do this with a couple of people, you begin to heal that attachment. And then it gets better and better. And you challenge those thoughts. You troubleshoot when you, women are supposed to be able to go to each other when their emotions are high and their logic is low. Go to another woman whose logic is high and emotions are low and connect with her. And the other woman will talk you through it and decrease your agitation and then comfort you and increase your logic. And by the end of it, you may not have a solution, but you have bonded with her. You've shared with her. You've opened up. You've connected. You've received acceptance. And now you can actually think through the solution on your own. Women are supposed to be able to process with each other like this. Now we have therapists because we don't have anyone in our life that we can process things with. But that allows you to do that. So then when you have those thoughts, when it's the emotional impermanence of, hey, I haven't heard from this person in 10 minutes, you can actually contact them and say, hey, remember I told you I kind of have those irrational thoughts? Just checking in, is there anything I've done that has upset you, or is our relationship good? I might just be crazy right now. Hope that's okay. And the other person will come back, and instead of saying, what? No, you're weird. They'll say, oh, I do remember you talking to me about that. You're having one of those? Yeah, no, we're fine. Don't worry about it. We're good. And you can build that in so that the attachment starts to get repaired. That is the process in a nutshell. It's really hard to do on your own. That's why I coach it and teach it, because I had to do it on my own. But that is the process of going through it, facing your fears, having the talks, bonding with people. You release the oxytocin. You release all the brain chemicals you're supposed to be getting through the connections. That is the process of healing it, and it can be healed.
Mm. So do you have a process for So, you know, given that there are so many people with attachment mm-hmm. issues, and certainly there are going to be some people who have serious attachment issues that, mm-hmm. you know, put them in a category of a cluster B personality
sure.
disorder.
Sure.
Do you have a sort of formula for navigating those kind of relationships?
Navigating relationships with those people or helping those people navigate relationships?
Well, I'm assuming you have both, but and we can cover both. Mm-hmm. I would actually be interested in hearing about mm-hmm. both, but, you know, like when you're recovering or when you yourself are sort of somebody who has anxious attachment issues, mm-hmm. who's sort of a recovering anxietist, mm-hmm. I don't know, mm-hmm. but, you wouldn't want to go to a person who's not safe,
right?
You know, choose a person who's not safe or who has this sort of capacity for
Absolutely.
Manipulation or emotional abuse or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, how do you identify those people? And then once they're identified, like, how do you proceed?
Absolutely. Great question. So, and I get that a lot. So here's what it is you need to understand what your three core values are, your core principles, the things that drive you, even if you don't live to them, even if you violate them to earn approval from other people, right? Honesty, integrity, loyalty, chastity, you know, whatever those things might be, whatever your core values are and core beliefs, if they're religious beliefs too, whatever it is, what do you live to and what have you not been living to? So you're ashamed of. This is where self-hatred and self-loathing usually comes from. And then once you've identified your core principles, you find other people who share those core principles or uphold those core principles. You identify their core principles. You can talk to them about those values. And you need to find people who have life goals they are also living to that are informed by their core values. So then you're watching people live to their core values or not live to their core values. It's not about their talking. It's not about the words they say. It's not about how great they sound on paper. Are they living to their values? And are they living to their lifelong goals? And if so, they become predictable in a good way and trustworthy. Trustworthy to act upon those principles and goals. Because you're not the one keeping them moral and honest and good anymore. They are. And all you have to do is remind them that they're not living to those principles and goals. And they will correct their own behavior. Those are the people you can trust. The people who break your trust are the ones who will break their own principles first.
Interesting. So we're talking about integrity, really.
That is one of the big principles that you should watch as well. Yes, absolutely.
Very interesting. Okay, that's good. And then, you know, as difficult as those people can be, I think many of us love people like that mm-hmm. and are you know, intimately related to people like that. Mm-hmm. And so what is If you can't avoid somebody like that, or just say like, oh, this person does not have integrity, this, you know, I can't, mm-hmm. They're dishonest, they're not living up to, mm-hmm. they're betraying themselves, they're going to betray me, no thanks. If you don't have the ability to, you know, go no contact or just sort of quietly disappear, how do you manage?
You apply your own boundaries. And your boundaries are based on your principles and your goals. Many women especially struggle to apply boundaries because they feel selfish or rude for having boundaries. And often that comes back to anxious attachment style or avoidant attachment style, making people mad at you. But when you apply boundaries based on your goals and principles, you can explain them that way. Instead of saying, I can't talk to you because you make me feel bad. And the other person argues, well, you're just being selfish. Well, maybe you're right. Then, no, I can't really talk to you or have this relationship with you, or I'm laying down this line right here that I'm not going to let you cross, or I'm not going to do this thing you're asking me to do because it violates my goals, my principles, my values. It violates everything I believe in, and I can't do that. And a person who loves you won't ask you to do it. They'll say, oh, man, don't do that. No, don't really. Good. I'm glad you're holding that boundary. And a person who doesn't love you is the person who's going to say, come on, it's not a big deal. You're just... That's the person you stay away from. And if you can't, you just keep applying that boundary over and over and calmly say, I'm sorry, I can't. That violates this goal, this value, this principle. I'm going to ruin my life goals for this thing that you're wanting me to do. And I'm not going to do that. Or I'm going to hate myself for doing this because of what you're asking me to do. I can't do that. And when you keep applying that, those people either get the message and leave you alone, or they wander away because they think that you're a piece of crap. And then they can't get what they want out of you. Then either way, you've won. But sometimes they will also change and adjust, and they'll say, okay, I'm obviously not going to get that from you. So, okay, fine. Sometimes you can build it that way too.
Okay. All right. Very interesting. So, gosh, I'm trying to think. Did we cover everything? Oh, there's one more thing that I wanted to ask you about, and I know we're running low on time, so we can make this quick.
Sure.
But the hormone vasopressin, as it relates to relationships with men, what is that? What is it? Why don't people talk about it? And how does it function?
It is a bonding hormone that is older than oxytocin. So oxytocin is love and care and nurturing, holding hands, right? Brushing the hair, someone else's hair, taking a walk with them, having a laugh with them, you know, playing a game with them, kissing, making out. That is oxytocin. Vasopressin is solving a problem together, solving a challenge together, working as a team to overcome some kind of stress together, solving a puzzle together, successfully, you know, hunting the mammoth together. You can see how this would be big for men. Big surprise, men are goal-oriented. But when men or women and men solve challenges together, the chemical vasopressin, one of the things it does in your body, is bond you to the other person who is solving that problem with you. It's your brain tagging that person and saying, this is a person I can solve challenges with. This is a person I need on my side when I'm stressed. I can trust this person. And then when you get into a crisis later, that your brain tags and says, I can turn toward that person to help me in this crisis, instead of I have no one to help me. And a research shows that when a couple is bonded through vasopressin and they hit a crisis point, the man, instead of turning away and cheating on her, will turn toward his wife and say, let's solve this together as a team. Most men, if they have good attachment, will do that. Vasopressin is the key to staying together, and it's the key to male bonding especially.
That is very interesting to me. It's one of those aspects of your work that I thought was super unique, because so many people talk about, I think, and once again, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me like very much of the psychology and sort of therapy industry is built around and for women. Mm-hmm. And sort of describing feelings and needs and emotions in terms of female needs and emotions and all that. And so that, you know, that when I observed your work on this, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Since this is a Valentine's era, moving into February episode, and we've talked about men and women and now vasopressin, let's close with, how can we build our relationships and incorporate that hormone or build it and help us fuse?
All the typical date ideas of having a walk in the park, going on a picnic, holding hands, you know, watching a funny movie, going to dinner together. Many of those are oxytocin bonding. Vasopressin would be taking a class together, cooking something new together, and accomplishing a great meal together as a team. It would be repairing something around your house, repairing a car, rebuilding something in your house, redecorating together. It would be even doing a jigsaw puzzle together. It could be going to an escape room together. It could be letting him teach you a skill and then you practice it and you both gain accomplishment from your growth in that skill. Anytime you can high five at the end of it and say, we did this, that is a vasopressin bonding moment. And you can have incredible vasopressin bonding dates that give you vasopressin and oxytocin. And especially afterward, once you have that vasopressin, you will want to oxytocin, and so will he, frankly.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. This has been such an interesting conversation. I know you have to go to your live stream, so I'm not going to hold you up. But I will say for my listeners, as always, that all of Adam's links are going to be in the description box below. And I highly recommend that you follow him on YouTube and on Twitter, especially. He's a great thread maker. I don't know if that's the correct terminology, but I like your threads.
Awesome.
All right. But anyway, thank you, Adam, for being with me tonight. This has been enlightening and a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun. I hope people get use out of this.
Thank you.